Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. It is 12 minutes after 12 o'clock on this Thursday afternoon. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, and I'm glad that you are. Dennis Rodkin is in the studio. He writes for Crane Chicago Business about real estate. Stops by from time to time. Dennis, welcome back.
Hi, Steve.
And we're going to talk about some big honking houses today, aren't we?
Huge houses, yeah, 10 to 30,000 square feet.
Let's start. That's bigger than my small town, I think. I grew up in a really small town.
You know, some of these houses look like small towns.
Let's start in Burr Ridge, because this is a fascinating story for me. Unfinished house.
Unfinished. And, in fact, that one's even bigger. That's 36,000. And you know what? That's downsized. They were originally, when they were building it over 10 years ago, I took a tour with the father. It was a father and son building it. And they were headed for 41,000 square feet under roof.
Now, the guy who put it together was in, looks like, in the mortgage industry.
Was in the mortgage industry. And I'm not clear on how it got transferred, but it is now owned by somebody else. I couldn't get the details. They're not. It was not a foreclosure. And that owner has just put it on the market unfinished. Not a whit of work has been done, as far as I can determine, since I was in it in 2007. I was in it in 06 and in 07 when work ground to a halt. And as far as I can tell, this 36,000, formerly 41,000 square foot house has been just frozen in amber all that time. And so now you can buy it unfinished.
So there's probably a couple bathrooms in this, right?
Yeah, there are. I don't recall the exact number, but I think it's about a dozen. There's an indoor and an out, or there was going to be an indoor and an outdoor pool. I don't know the finished state of those.
Well, that's the thing you say was going to be, because there are pictures of the exterior,
yeah,
but nothing of the interior. We don't even know how far along this house is.
Yeah, and I could not get any determination. As I said, the seller won't talk to me, but the municipal or the county officials who are in charge say that as far as they know, nothing has happened since 07. And at that time, when I walked through it, most of the walls were unfinished. I mean, I think the inside looks probably a lot like the outside, which is, you know, wrapped in Tyvek, the construction wrap, and things like that.
So it's a 30,000 square foot.
Steve, come on, it's 36,000.
36,000 square foot, and it's a fixer-upper already, never lived in.
Exactly, never lived in, totally unfinished. And you know, that one, you've seen the picture, that actually looks like a little village on a hill.
It does,
it's so
yeah.
Big.
Let's go to Barrington, then. And these are homes that have been lived in by and large. But again, they're the mega mansions,
right?
And it looks like maybe the market's sort of going away for those.
Well, the market's going away, but also too many of them have come onto the market. There are so there's that one in Burr Ridge, and there are other mega mansions on the market, hard to sell around the region, onesies and twosies in different locations. But in the Barrington area, 19 of them.
Wow.
And a dozen of them have been on the market for at least 5 years. One has been on, and some of them not continuously. They've been on the market, off the market. One has been on the market since 2004.
And they're dropping $1 million off the price or more.
Some of them are, because there have been some sales recently. People have pulled their prices down. One, I think we talked about, had been on the market for 10 years when it finally sold. And so those kind of establish a new benchmark, right? I got to bring my price down to that if I'm going to sell. Or, as a couple of these agents told me, they don't bring the price down because they can afford to wait. I put in X, right, and I'm not selling this thing till I get X back out.
I suppose if you could afford to build it in the first place, you can afford to wait for your price.
Yeah, as far as I can tell, many of these are built for cash. So it actually hurts, you know, to sell at a loss because you've lost cash, not financing.
All right, we're going to talk about this next subject with no wiener puns.
No.
The Oscar Mayer house in Evanston is up for sale?
Is up for
sale,
yeah.
You can't do it. I don't think you can do it.
I'm trying so hard not to. I'm totally stumped, Steve.
Oscar
Mayer lived in this house. It was built in the early 1900s, but Oscar Mayer Sr. lived in the house from the 20s until his death in the 1960s. For about the last 10 years, it has been vacant, and a pair of developers bought it in mid-2015. They're doing a massive rehab. They're trying to take it mostly back to its origins, though keeping a couple of things that were done in the 30s that are sort of fun. There's this crazy sort of Moorish crown molding in what was another type of room, but is going to be the family room.
Right.
But it's huge. And the thing about it, it's 7,500 square feet. I believe it's 6 bedrooms. It's on a beautiful historical street in Evanston. And actually, the price is pretty darn good for a completely rehabbed house of that scale, in part because they've sort of funded this rehab by selling a piece of the land.
So it's been rehabbed, and it looks beautiful now. But
it's in the process of being rehabbed. Okay. Well, it looks a lot better because it was shrouded. It was like wearing a big wig of ivy before, and all that's been stripped away. But they're putting it on the market now not planning to be. That wasn't a sausage
joke.
No,
I'm trying to work in. It's like sausage being made. You don't want to see it, but I'm.
Exactly.
It's not even going to
work.
There
you go.
Okay, so we've been.
Can we say though the real estate agent? I got to make this sausage reference. There's nothing Oscar Mayer related in the house, but the real estate agent is giving away little keychains with sausages on them. So there you go.
So that's kind of the fun stuff because I didn't want to talk about the dark stuff.
Yeah.
The new homes are really slow here. The housing recovery with the numbers we've seen lately, it's just the rebound isn't coming to Chicago.
We continue to be the least recovered city, least recovered major city in America on home values. We've got this zone of great recovery, 99 blocks of the lakefront from 35th Street all the way to Rogers Park. Very well recovered, new peaks in home values, beating the old boom year values. But for the most of the region, we're still trying to recover to those points.
And that run along the lakefront ends at Rogers Park. I mean, if you go up to the North Shore, they're suffering too.
Stops at Devon Avenue. This is the data I've got. And by the way, south of 35th Street, there just isn't sufficient data for Case-Shiller to work this out. There may be more recovery in places like Hyde Park, but we don't know. But from 35th Street to Devon Avenue, all at new peak price levels, from Devon Avenue, which is the southern end of Rogers Park, all the way to the Wisconsin line on the lakefront, so North Shore, as well as places like Waukegan, still well below their peaks.
And the inventory, what's on the market, is still pretty thin?
In the city, it's very thin. In the suburbs, especially some of those suburbs, it's
pretty thick.
I guess
in Barrington, it's pretty thick.
Yeah, in Barrington and in the North Shore, way too many houses on the market, which sort of keeps recovery from speeding up because I can pay less when there are so many options, I can price you down.
So things usually speed up a little bit in the spring and summer. Do you see that happening?
No.
Yesterday,
some national data came out that showed that in a lot of the fastest moving cities of the past year and a half, they're slowing down. Not slow, but slowing down from where they were. And we showed a little bit of a slowdown as well. No, you know, it hasn't been the super fantabulous spring that we might have wanted, but I'd like to say I wrote a story in the winter saying spring may be disappointing. I'd like to be proven wrong. Maybe in the next few months things turn a little faster, but so far it's been...
I'm sure I read that story. I've just blocked it out because I need some good news, Dennis.
Exactly. Well, Steve, I have not delivered good news in 10 years.
Let's try to get in a couple weeks then. Dennis Rodkin from Crane Chicago Business. Nice to see you again.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Mark, there's a bit of a walkout at the University of Illinois today, and the people on strike say they will be in strike until finals next week. Robin Kaler is a spokeswoman for the school, and she joins us on a phone line now. Robin, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me, this is about teachers, as I understand it, about 500 teachers who are on a non-tenured track. Can you explain for me what they do?
Actually, it's about 400 teachers. The other members of the group are not in teaching roles. But there are people who help deliver education to our students. They perform a very important role.
All right, so if there's a student who has, say, a philosophy class, might it be taught only by one of these people, or are they more teacher's aides, or exactly what's their relationship with the students?
No, they're actual faculty members, teachers, and they have course sections just like anyone else would.
If they're described as being on a non-tenure track, does that mean it's like an adjunct situation or they're not going to be there permanently? I just want to understand that a little bit.
It's year to year. That's correct.
Okay. And I know they've been talking. They've never had a collective contract. You've been talking, I think, maybe since October of 2014, as I understand it. So is it in the school's interest to get a collective bargaining agreement with this group?
I would like to clarify, we've been talking for quite some time, yes, but it's a new contract. This is a new group, a new union, and when you create a contract with a new group, it always takes a longer time than it would to renew a contract, for example. So it is not unusual for something like this to take quite a bit of time because everybody's very cautious and wants to make sure they get every word right. And, of course, you're starting from a blank piece of paper instead of updating a document.
You clarify all you want because I'm trying to understand this as best I can. Do you think there will be an agreement?
We sure hope so. We're all working very hard to try to make it so. And we really feel that the best thing that everyone can do is actually, stay involved in mediation and let that process play out.
I'm interested in how this impacts the students, because from what I read, this group says it will be on a 5-day strike, which takes you to finals. So I would imagine these students are going to miss a couple, or could miss a couple of class sessions that could be sort of key ahead of their taking their final exams.
Yes, and that's unfortunate. Anytime there's a disruption in education, that's concerning to us. It is important to point out that it is a relatively small group of people. Of those 400, we know that last week when they did a 2-day strike, about 80 of them participated. So out of the thousands of people we have delivering instruction, it's about 80 people. But anytime there's a disruption, that's important to us. And we certainly share the goals of the people in this group. We just have different paths on which to achieve those goals, and we're trying to now find a common path.
So if we're talking about 400 teachers, you're saying that doesn't necessarily mean that 400 classes are being untaught or teachers are out of the classroom. They're not all walking.
Correct. Correct.
Okay. And in the situation where they are walking, and, let's go back to that philosophy class, and my teacher's not there, I've got finals next week, will there be changes made to the schedule by the University of Illinois if those sessions don't take place?
We'll cross that bridge when we come to it, but we always have plans in place for if a teacher cannot complete a class, for example. I mean, people, have illnesses and other things that happen occasionally. So there are plans that happen. Those all happen at the departmental level, though. So that's not something that's mandated by the campus, for example.
So it wouldn't be a university-wide situation?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Talks are scheduled for tomorrow?
Correct. Tomorrow, and we've got a session scheduled Tuesday if necessary.
Robin Kaler, a spokeswoman for the University of Illinois. You helped very much. Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're quite welcome. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN as we go back to the 80s there briefly, I think. Right? They're probably 1980s. Elise Glink is in the studio. Think Glink and all of that. Where do we find you, Elise?
At Glink on Twitter. Actually, I'll be doing a Nerd Wallet Nerd Chat in about an hour. So I'll be on Twitter very actively.
Nice.
Talking about real estate.
So last time we spoke to you, you had broken out of the jury room at Cook County Circuit Court.
I know. And I escaped. That was very, it's a lovely room they now have for everybody.
But is that truly? Really?
It is. It's nice. It's clean. It's empty. There's no, nobody's wandering in and out. You can only be there if you have your little jury duty badge, but after a while I was really ready for some fresh air.
So did you get called?
No, I never did.
Really? Just kind of
went down to the room once, never even got to sit on the bench, and went back upstairs, and that was it for the day.
So it's like a stress detox for a day. You go in and you kind of unwind? Do they lead yoga classes?
Yeah, they
for
do.
The,
they
for,
should anyway.
So that the jurors are in a healthy state of mind?
Yeah, we bring all of our fatty food back from Daily Plaza,
nice,
and then we
nice.
Sit up there and
a healthy
yoga.
State of mind, that's kind of what Money Smart Week is about, isn't it?
It is. This is one of my favorite weeks of the year. I was around at the very beginning, about 14 years ago, and I was working at the time at WGN-TV, and Carol Fowler, who was the news director at the time, came in with a huge stack, and all the news directors in town from television and radio had a mandatory appearance call at the Fed. They feed you well, they got lunch, and they were told that we're going to start this thing called Money Smart Week. So she came and dumped a huge folder on my desk and said, well, you're our money lady. Do something with this.
Make it work.
Make it work. And so what I did was create a week of programming. And what is and at the beginning, we were like, oh, there are hundreds of things and there's six languages. Okay, today it's national. There are tens of thousands of free programs about money this week. This is Financial Literacy Month in addition to being Money Smart Week. And here in Chicago, every day I'm just amazed to page through the dozens and dozens of free offerings here in Chicago in the state of Illinois.
I think, and I've been talking, I was telling you off the air with some people about there's kind of an apprehension to start because you think you're already behind or you already don't know. So
right.
Rather than look, I'm just going to continue with my head in the ground, whether it's with a 401k or a savings retirement plan or health insurance or anything like that.
Everybody is so afraid. It's really interesting. So Tuesday night I participated with the YWCA. They did a Smart Women, Smart Money seminar over at the CBO, Chicago Board Options Exchange. And I hadn't been there in 100 years. That was so fun. And they, you know, I sat on the panel with this esteemed group of women, and we talked about our earliest money memories, and we talked about mistakes we had made and smart moves we had made. And people were able to ask questions, and I think it was a wake-up call for a lot of people. They're all interested, or they wouldn't have been there, but to hear people who are so-called experts in the field talk about our own money mistakes was eye-opening.
Yeah, it's empowering in some ways, right?
It is. Knowledge. We all make mistakes. You have to.
All right, so there's a lot of stuff left this week that people can sign up for and check out?
Yeah, I was looking online, so you go to moneysmartweek.org. And I was looking for today, and today you could learn borrowing basics, learn about your 401k. Fifth Third is having an event about empowering small business owners, which is great. You can learn about chip cards and the latest biometric technology coming soon to a credit card near you.
Yeah, I was talking about that earlier, these chip cards. And, you know, now every time I use my credit card with the magnetic strip, they're like, well, is this a chip? Is it a chip?
Is it a chip?
Like, no, it's not. I do have one chip card, but most of my cards are not.
Right, and soon they will all be chip cards. This
by
chip,
law, right?
Yeah, and chip technology has actually been in use in Europe for a long time. It's much, much safer than the swipe technology that we have now. But also we're going to start seeing biometrics. So there's companies out there that have developed technology where you imprint your fingerprints on your credit card. It'll be swiped in a certain way, and then only if your fingerprints match your real person who's charging will you be able to use the card.
So right now with the computer chip, it's just all it is a harder to duplicate sort of form of ID, right?
Right. It was like money when they redid the money and they put the strip in.
Right.
Right.
So it's not communicating with my bank or anything like that.
All the information is encoded on that card.
And
to the best of my understanding.
So the biometrics. So I'm going to have to soon use my thumbprint to buy bubblegum at the Walgreens?
Yeah, it could be like when you come back from
because it's
you know,
already pretty slow at the Walgreens, just so you know.
Oh God, you know. Don't you wish it just all happened like lightning?
Yes,
like, I was back in the studio getting ready to come on air, and I was like, come on, please, connect. What the heck is going on here?
You'll need the thumbprint just to
Yeah, I mean, think about when you go to O'Hare now, and you've got the GoPro stuff, and you've got the GOES program, right? What they've done is when you check in internationally, everybody now goes to a terminal. And then after the terminal, you either need to go see the man or woman, or you can go straight through.
When you return. Right.
And this is all about fingerprint technology, and that kind of stuff is being brought into our credit cards and other kinds of things.
So I worry about the business owners a little bit because that's got to be expensive.
Yeah, keeping up with this technology, which is now so rapidly changing, is an investment that they have to make. Plus, credit card companies are charging 2, 3, 4, even 5% for using them. So no wonder when they keep asking you for cash.
Can I tell you a scary story? Sure. You know, I lead these trips to Europe, and we were coming back from Ireland one time. And when you come back from, they take your picture, right, at customs, and then they print out your sort of boarding pass with your picture on it. They got the pictures out of order.
Oh, no.
So a buddy
Who
of
did
mine,
you look like?
I didn't, but a buddy of mine got a picture that looked like not him. It was another guy, but we didn't know who the guy was. And so the picture comes out, and, you know, not to be – not to profile myself a little bit, but, you know, if you were to draw a caricature of a terrorist-looking guy, that's what the picture looked like.
Oh, no!
And so we ended up finding the guy was in a line above 10 people ahead of us. So that was kind of a scary thing. So the technology doesn't always work so well.
Yeah, when they're pairing up your face with somebody else's name, it could be very, very terrifying.
Yeah, no one wants to do that.
But anyway, in terms of money this week, there's so many other kinds of things that you can learn about. Every day, if you wanted to learn about health insurance, I guarantee if you go to moneysmartweek.org, you'll find something near you that talks about health insurance. So all different kinds of money issues.
And it's one of those things that take advantage of it because there's probably a lot of things you don't know, and there's to quote Donald Rumsfeld, we don't know what we don't know.
Well, you know me. I am all about giving you the best information that you need about money, about real estate, helping you make better, smarter financial decisions. And I'm telling you, if you can get super smart people for free to help you with your money, you're silly not to do so.
Elise Glink, thanks for coming by. I appreciate it. Good
Always
to see you.
Always a pleasure. See you soon.
You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. It's The Office. You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Let's talk about office space, but maybe a new and growing form of office space. Raymond Rabar is in the studio. He's the CEO of MakeOffices.com, and this is now Well, I'm not going to explain it. You explain it for me, Raymond. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. Thanks.
So you're involved in office space, offices of different sizes, but is short of a year-long lease or a month-long lease, people can move in and out, right? And it's a growing trend.
Correct. Yeah. Co-working, it's a new economy, sharing economy for office space, and everything we do is month-to-month, like you'd mentioned, and it's the growing trend of how people want to consume their office space.
So say I'm a freelancer, or say I'm a company based in New York, and I've got some things going on in Chicago. I would go to someone like you, right, and rent something for a week or two?
We do have several companies, actually, coincidentally, in Chicago. We'd opened back on January 4th this year. We have several companies that are actually doing that to test the market here in Chicago. They're renting office with us. Typically not as short as 2 weeks, typically a month or 2 months to test out the market.
Right.
It's a little hard to do something for just 2 weeks, but...
So same for an individual, if I wanted to go and work,
We have plans for all sorts of companies, from one-person companies up to we have 25-person companies.
I was reading in your publicity that you offer a bar or something like that, too.
We do. It becomes a talking point for a lot of people, but we have several different beers on tap. We have several different wine producers. We also have a very, very nice, elegant coffee bar in all of our spaces as well.
So I want to talk about your locations and your growth plans here, but first of all, I'm fascinated by the architecture or geography of innovation. It's just something that I've been drawn to, you know, and different cities have tried to create these innovation centers and things like that. But one of the things central to it is they want people from different sorts of professions and different sorts of mentalities to commingle, to associate with themselves. And in a way, that's what happens at Make Offices and these other sort of temporary office sites, right? You've got people from several different industries or businesses or forms of employment intermingling and sharing ideas.
That is absolutely correct. There are some co-working companies that they only focus on one industry. We do not. We actually try and have every industry. And to date, I can't think of a single industry we don't have in one of our offices, which is kind of awesome. But if you are a small company and you need help on UX design, or you need an accountant, or you need a lawyer, or you need help forming your board, or you need help getting clients or marketing or digital marketing or anything, you can probably walk down the hall and find a really good company that can help you with that service.
And so I've read that people who go to these co-working facilities tend to be happier in their jobs than those of us who don't. Can you explain that for me?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons for that. One, obviously, we have the social aspect of where we work and the community that we build, and it allows people to build real relationships, both social and professionally. And the professional relationships help you for a long time in your career, and the social relationships are great. When you walk into a small company, if you were segregated and you were in a part of a very small company, there was nobody to have lunch with. Mm-hmm. There was nobody to grab coffee with. There was nobody to do anything with or bounce an idea off of or get really excited about something. Now, even though you're still a three-person company, there's hundreds of people around you that you can go and talk to.
You're talking about our brighter side. I'm more interested in our darker side. because when you're in an office space sometimes and you're surrounded by people working for the same company, you get a little competitive, right? Or there can be rivalries, and that doesn't sort of foster creativity and innovation.
Yeah, that is certainly true. Part of it is how the company is going to deal with their company culture. With us, the cool part is, unless you're literally directly competing, you probably want to help the other company.
Well, that's what I mean. If you're in a co-working situation, you're not competing with the person who's two doors down from you.
You're very likely not going to.
Right. And so, and the other thing is, there are guys or women who are working at home in their basement, isolated all day long, right? That's a growing sort of clientele for you guys.
Yeah, you know, equally between Fortune 500s joining us as well as freelancers and independent contractors joining us, we've been seeing a huge influx, and it's literally been people who used to be at a Starbucks or coffee shop or working from home have been joining us, but almost equally to Fortune 500s who have been joining us.
So I wonder then how you – do you try to foster society in these places, or do you just let that happen organically? Because I'm thinking if you're going to the Starbucks, you're surrounded by people, but you might not be surrounded by conversation. Is that something that happens more organically when you go to Make Offices?
So for the most part, we try and let it happen organically. We do help but foster that behind the scenes. The way we set up and organize our offices is we allow for these collision points. So the coffee is a tremendous place to go and meet and see people. And since you're seeing the same people all the time, you end up striking conversation. But there's one centralized place to get coffee at all of our locations.
Raymond Rabar is the CEO of Make Offices. Mm-hmm. And you got two spots now?
We have two in Chicago.
And you got one coming.
We have one more coming.
How do people find more information about it?
Please go to our website, makeoffices.com, and schedule a tour and come and check it out. And for everybody that's listening on WGN, we'd love to offer your first 3 months half off so you can try and experience it for yourself.
Wait, can I get like a nap room? I'll just go over there and take a nap.
We do have nap rooms. We have massage rooms.
You
we
do
have wellness
not.
Rooms.
You
we
do not.
We absolutely do.
And so what happens if I have office space with you, then you pay another fee to get the massage or the nap? Or
no, everything we do is all inclusive. If we offer it, it's free. So if you want to go in, we have anti-gravity massage chairs. If you want to go and take a nap in those or just relax for a little while, take a break throughout the day, go for it.
All right, I'll see you later this afternoon, Raven.
Sounds good.
MakeOffices.com. You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN.